This is Hacker Public Radio episode 3118 for Wednesday, the 15th of July 2020. Today's show is entitled Linux in Laws Season 1 Episode 10 The Python Bumper Part 1 and is part of the series Linux in Laws. It is the 10th anniversary show of Monochromec and is about 91 minutes long and carries an explicit flag. The summary is a discussion of Python questions and their answers. Part 1. Plus news on Brad and Alia.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by archive.org. Support universal access to all knowledge by heading over to archive.org/donate.
Linux in Laws, a podcast on topics around free and open source software, any associated contraband, communism, the revolution in general, and whatever else fancies your tickle. Please note that this and other episodes may contain strong language, offensive humor, and other certainly not politically correct language. You have been warned. Our parents insisted on this disclaimer. Happy Mum! Thus, the content is not suitable for consumption in the workplace, especially when played back on a speaker in an open plan office or similar environments. Any minors under the age of 35 or any pets, including fluffy little killer bunnies, your trusted guide dog, unless on speed, and cute T-Rexes or other associated dinosaurs. Martin, good evening. How are things?
Good evening, Chris. Things are great. How about you?
Excellent. Can't complain. Beer is stocked, so we're ready to roll for another episode of Linux in Laws. Season 1, episode, what is it, 10, right?
10, yes. Well done, man.
Excellent. So, for this episode, we have the usual news feed in stock, then a little bit of Python, maybe some funny ramblings, and then it's feedback, and then we're done. I think.
Maybe a lot of Python.
Depending. Martin had the idea of doing a special on Python, as in special episode on Python, so this is what we're doing today. Martin is posing as a novice, and I try to draw as little as, what's what I'm looking for, as few blanks as possible on the questions that Martin's going to ask me.
And you don't know what these questions are either, do you?
I wouldn't have a clue.
A good skill.
Same thing with Python, so let's see what I can come up with.
So why would you do this exactly? Yeah.
Because okay. This was your idea. I don't know.
Yeah, you volunteered to be the expert on this.
Well, as I said, let's see how fair, how I can measure up.
Excellent. Okay, shall we...
The news, yes.
Dive right in. Oh, no. The news. What about Stackless?
That's not news. That's old news.
That's not news.
No.
Okay.
No,
right, so what is
news?
The
news, yes. Kernel release 5.8. A guy called Linus Torvalds, I don't know if that rings a bell, claims...
I think we mentioned him last show.
Yeah, probably. I think there's this operating system called Linux that he invented more than 20 years ago. More than 20 years ago? More than 20 years. 25 years and a bit, I think. Linus, if you're listening, please send feedback. I think it's 92, but we might be off. Okay. Linus has gone public with the fact that 5.8, which is just basically in the state of release candidate, it will be the biggest release ever, he says.
Oh, well, until 5.9, surely?
No, if apparently what happened, they did a lot of new functionality in terms of core kernel functionality, not just kind of device drivers and stuff, but all the rather scheduling amendments, file system amendments, and all the rest of it as part of this release. So I'm really looking forward to kind of put this into production and see how it measures up. Also, apparently, some subsystems were, how can I put this, subjected to some performance optimizations. Like what?
Well, you just mentioned performance optimizations. What are they?
You'll find the details in the show notes. No, more like file systems. I think they did a lot of work on the schedulers, both I/O and process schedulers. For the people who are not familiar with the intrinsics of the Linux kernel, the schedulers essentially take care of running things like user land processes, depending on the state of various contexts. Like if, for example, a program is waiting on I/O, needless to say, it doesn't make much sense to run this program because the program would just be idling. So if you're trying to read from a file, being, for example, ls, like list, or some application, the kernel will put you on hold, so to speak, while you're waiting for the disk drive to deliver the data. Similar...
Which, in turn, has its own scheduler.
Indeed, yes. Similar with kind of general user space threads, or rather processes, as probably we all know, Linux is a so-called multi-tasking, multi-user operating system, similar to something called Unix ages ago. So the idea is being a typical time
what
slice.
About next step? Was that a
say again?
What about next step? Was that a multi-user?
Yes, that's another operating system.
Yeah, was it also?
Yeah, in contrast, yes, in contrast to Linux, actually, NextStep, if spelled incorrectly, has the power to summon planet eaters.
Deep.
For long-time listeners of the show. Anyway, going back to Linux. Yes, the idea is, of course, to give you the illusion that you're using a mainframe or a smaller size computer, basically by yourself. So the way it's done, essentially, each and every user using a Linux system, similar to Unix, gets a so-called time slice for the execution of their programs. And this is what you see, actually, if you deploy a lot of applications on a Linux system, the operating system is doing its best to maintain that illusion. Sometimes slowing you down, but still divvying up the available processing power between the different users and their processes. So these are the kind of the main approaches to scheduling tasks or processes or threads in Linux and other processing operating systems.
But there are some optimizations which are going to be revealed in the show notes. Yeah,
absolutely.
Okay. No, that's curious. It's something that's. I mean, with the this subsystem, there's a lot of different schedulers anyway in the first place, right? So it's curious to see. I didn't pick up on that fact.
Well, Linux has about 27 years of maybe 26 of development time incorporated in it. So that's a lot of time to get things right. And that's exactly what you see in the kernel, because all of the various subsystems where it doesn't make sense have their, for example, their own scheduling. That goes for networks, for the whole network stack. That goes for disks. That goes for a user land process and all the rest of it.
Okay. As a Linux user, how involved do you get in this kind of changing of schedulers?
It's straightforward. I mean, if you want to give a process a different priority, for example, you use a command called nice. Nice directly affects the scheduling priority.
Changing the scheduler itself, though.
No.
Okay.
No, for this you need root rights as an admin rights. And kids, don't try this at home unless you want to screw up your system, because if you don't know what you're doing, you can easily bring a system to its knees. And this is normally why the userland is heavily guarded from such attempts. For example, NICE allows you, being an ordinary user, only allows you to increase the NICE value, thus lowering the priority of your of your process. Only the root user can actually reduce the NICE value, thus effectively increasing the priority of a process and and the corresponding threads.
Excellent.
So what other news do we have, Martin?
Well, what other news do we have? Does it have to be open source?
No, it can be anything. Just go ahead. Another data breach, perhaps?
Another breach. No, no data breaches, as far as I'm aware, this time. No, no, no.
Okay.
No, the one of the news things I don't know if it's news as such, but in the it is related to open source, but yeah. So in our line of work, there are many companies that take an open core project and monetize this, right?
But that's not news.
No, it's not news. The news is really that this continues to happen with pretty much any open source project out there. So,
yes.
Which I'd just like to. It's not news, but it's just something that has struck me time and time again over the last week that so many people are doing this, and it kind of goes against the open source, the idea, right? Okay, yes, they're adding features and this thing or whatever, but just like to see your view on that.
Well, I mean, we both work for an open core company. Full disclosure, we are both employed by a company called Redis Labs. The money has to come from somewhere, right? I mean, you can go down the next cloud route, as in just provide support or even Red Hat, because that's essentially what Red Hat is doing. Just provide support, professional service training around this. And then there's the other approach, basically open core, meaning that some of the IP would be closed source. And that's exactly what the likes of Confluent, Redis Labs, DataSex, and all the rest of them are doing. I see the merits with both approaches, because at the end of the day, somebody has to pay the bills. Needless to say, companies like Nextcloud and Red Hat are just closer to communism, like the other ones, because all of their IP is in the open.
This is it, right? It's there are many. Well, there are different approaches to this. It's just every, you get all these new ones coming up all the time, because every time someone starts a new open source project, and then someone has a great idea to launch a company around it, and it's kind of, there has to be a better way to make open source proliferate rather than through commercial means. I haven't it's just something, it's not news, but it's something that struck me over the past week. It just isn't, with all these, with the number of new ones coming along as well, right? There's tons of them that are doing stuff based on Druid and stuff based on Apache Camel and this and that and the other. It's any open source project you can find that there'll be a startup around it, right, trying to monetize it. So bit of a rant rather than news, but.
I mean, that's okay. I mean, if you take a look at any enterprise in this current time, as in now, you don't have to dig deep. You'll find open source left, right, and center. If it's and even if it's just their mail system, or their printing system, or their virus scanner, you'll find a piece of open source in every enterprise, no matter what, in terms of size, number of people, revenue, and so forth. As a matter of fact, it's not the debate if whether a company should use open source. It's just a matter of basically how much open source is a company willing to bet on in terms of, for example, new product development. Of course, that also affects the overall ecosystem that they use to develop their apps. For example, the licensing is pretty determining here. Is that what I'm looking for? Is the determining factor, yes. In terms of, for example, take the GPL, the GNU Puppet License version 2, version 3, or even for the hyperscalers, the Alfaro GPL, as in a more strict version of the GPL. If you touch a piece of code that is licensed under the GPL, you are supposed, and there have been many lawsuits on that matter, to publish your changes, because that's exactly what the GPL says. You take the source code, you touch it, you modify it, and then the public has a right to access your modifications. In contrast to more liberal licenses like 3-Clause BSD, MIT, Apache, you name it, that allow you pretty much to do what you want with the source code, maybe apart from the fact that you have to credit the origin or something like this. But it doesn't restrict the usage of that source code. So if you have this great idea of doing the next big thing, like the new Netflix, the new Amazon, the new eBay, needless to say, you don't want to write your stack completely by yourself because you rely on open source components.
Of course. Mm-hmm.
That saves you time, that saves you effort, that saves you manpower. But, and this is a very important but, you want to make sure that you pick the right components in terms of, does the license restrictions fit your business model? Deployment options. If you are putting a piece of code that is especially licensed under a Alfaro GPL, you cannot use this basically to run in your cloud. Same goes, for example, I have to cut this out because the interfaces are slightly more complicated. Best example, Redis Labs has something called a source available license. Being a hyperscaler, you cannot take a code base license under this and put it into your cloud. So that restricts the usage options. And there has been a big debate about this in the OSI circles and so forth. There was a first time talk by Chris Lamb and friends about contributing to Redis module code bases that made the rounds. And as I said, I can see both sides, because the money has to come from somewhere, because what the likes of AWS and friends do, and Microsoft and Google are probably the exceptions that prove that rule, because if you take a look at their track record, they tend to partner with these open source projects and companies behind them. Confluent and Redis Labs probably being the best examples, never mind MariaDB and so forth.
Yeah, but Amazon being the old one out, right?
That's exactly it, and maybe even SoftLayer, or what's now IBM Cloud, or even Oracle. They take the code base, they put a managed wrapper around it, they charge for it, but they don't give anything back.
Yeah, exactly, but also they make their own improvement and changes, right? Which if you are serious about this stuff, you should be doing that rather than, and it's the same with, even consumers of open source in the large enterprise, in my opinion. They could be, instead of, paying vendors for support and so on, they could also be contributing to the projects and keeping them going that way, and improving them rather than going for a pure consumer model.
They don't. How much has AWS contributed back? Oh, sorry, Amazon back to the Redis code base in terms of making it compatible with the hyperscaler infrastructure? I cannot recall seeing any pull requests here.
In contrast,
Microsoft, of course, any contribution to the Linux kernel, because it was under a different license model, because since, I think, 94, Linux has been under the GPL, so Microsoft had to push any changes back into the code base. So any changes that they made in order to have the kernel running on something called Azure, they had to contribute back. From a legal perspective, but then they coupled into the fact that Linux is there to stay, whereas Windows and the server world in production, Jira's still out on that. So But then Microsoft is changing in a very big way. Speaking of Python, I think they at least employ one or even two core contributors to something called CPython, which is standard reference implementation for Python on any platform, whether it's OS X, Windows, or Linux and derivatives. And if you take a look at their open source code base, it's growing all the time. PowerShell, probably being the best example, PowerShell Core is free and open source. Visual Studio Code, next thing.
Yep. Agreed. So, yeah, good points there. But, yeah, it's all yet to be resolved in a satisfactory manner, right? There's the two camps and, well, it's more than two, but those are amongst the cloud vendors, those are the two big ones. And, the enterprises out there don't really seem to care about the ethics of these companies, do they?
Until we order fewer books.
Well, I think they've done quite well out of the current situation. Books. Indeed.
Okay. Martin.
What was the thing? Cut something.
Anyway, I'm going to edit this out. Okay.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah.
Let's start with this Python thing, Martin. Why don't you explain to us what Python really is and where you are in your learning curve with regards to language?
Questions. Okay. I can do that. That's fine. Right. So where am I on my learning curve? Well, so I have a slightly different approach to yourself, I think, to many of these things.
What's my approach then?
Your approach is to, let's say, take everything apart into the smallest detail. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes. That's, I think, a somewhat accurate description of my approach.
Okay. Well,
this is why open source is so important, because you can take the bloody thing apart and put it back together again, because the source code is available. Martin, on the other hand, apparently just likes to run things and then wonders about why this shit doesn't work.
Is it because it's open source? Anyway.
This only applies to Pulp Audio in some way, not all of it.
Yeah, oh my god. Where were we? So, yeah.
You were describing your more userland focused approach to software.
Indeed. Userland focused approach, yes. So, So from a programming perspective, went through many iterations many years ago, obviously. University did and it struck me also, you know, we'll come back to this later in the Python questioning section, I've always been more on the functional programming side personally, but there are many different options here. So anyway, going back to Python, it serves a purpose, it's easy to deploy, has a large package and library available for many different things. It is, so the more you do with it, the more you kind of realize how powerful it is, and also how much programming languages have moved on since the 1980s, I guess.
Full disclosure, listeners, if you look at Martin's LinkedIn profile, you quickly notice the fact that he has been, for most of his professional life, dealing with databases. Meaning, yes, you are listening to an SQL fanboy who copped onto the fact that SQL does not contain a go-to statement. This is the important thing, people.
For a good reason.
As a matter of fact, Martin, what I notice is actually that you have been administering Oracle database for quite some time.
Yes, that's part of my working life.
This is just a kind of a full disclosure thing before we enter the Python realm.
Due to the length of the original Python discussion, this session has been split into two parts, with the first part following now. Catch the next part in the next episode of Linux and Laws.
Okay, that's fair. Yeah, so, Yeah, Python and Oracle didn't really feature too much together for a long time, obviously. Even though, yeah, Python as a language is quite old. How old is it, Chris?
I think Guido devised around early 90s, 92, 93 maybe. So we're looking at 20 plus years easily. There's a Wikipedia page basically outlining the first commit, I suppose. For Guido von Rossum, if you're listening, Guido, well, good work, well done, keep it up. It was a summer project that he did while he was still at university. He was in charge of looking for a new language, and he took a look at what's out there and then came up with his new language better suiting his needs, and hence Python was developed. Mm-hmm. And the name, of course, does not come from a big snake, but rather a comedy troupe called Monty Python, of which Guido von Rossum, at least that's common lore, is a big comedy, fan yes. of, yes.
I wonder if Frank is a fan of Monty Python.
I do not know. Let's tackle this once we go to feedback.
Okay, sorry. Right. How is that for an introduction? What about your own experience with Python?
We used Python during the when we were looking for an implementation language for some of the QA harnesses when I was doing my PhD back in the early kind of mid-90s at a university called Trinity College Dublin in Dublin, Ireland itself. This is also when I first encountered something called Linux, which has been...
I thought you were going to say Guinness. But
no, yeah, Guinness... Guinness came before this, but okay. I've been using Linux ever since in some form or fashion afterwards. So,
actual Linux, not Unix or is it,
no Unix. I encountered mid 80s when I was studying computer science at various universities and schools, so to speak. But Linux we used as a platform to develop and test our experimental microkernel architecture that the research group was working on where I did my PhD. Okay. And this is where I also basically made the choice between Perl and Python, because Perl wasn't delivering the goods in the fashion that we required them to be. So we resorted to Python to write much of the QA code for the kernel. I almost forgot about Python until I rediscovered it, so to speak, late 2000s, in terms of 2008, 2009, where I was looking for a programming language to do quick and dirty prototyping with, and I've been using it ever since. Mm-hmm. And also kind of observing, let's put it this way, the growth of the ecosystem around that language. Because for me, Python means, similar to other programming language with a corresponding ecosystem, if you have a problem, you take a look at packages that are out there already and simply write the glue code that is missing to achieve the required functionality. Best example, a couple of years back, a friend of mine had about... when was it? How many Rustle plans were it? About a couple of 10,000, maybe 20,000, maybe 30,000 Rustle plans, as in schedules, that were stored in Excel spreadsheets. And he wanted to convert these to Google Calendar entries, for whatever reason. So he shopped around, and a consultancy quoted him at least 7 days FTE in terms of full-time equivalent for somebody to sit down and to develop this. He rang me. I sat down, did some research. I came up with something called LibreOffice. LibreOffice has a Python interface that is, let's put it this way, with some syntactic sugar on top of it in terms of another module, you can simply extract data from a spreadsheet that is in comma separated value form. So we simply wrote a small batch job that simply converted the Excel spreadsheets into CSVs, or as a matter of fact, I think we didn't do this because LibreOffice was already then able to read them. as in XLS X files.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Then we then the Python program extracted the values via this module or via this package rather, and of course the Google Calendar has a Python API. I wrote the code within 2 hours, another hour of testing, and the whole job was done within the afternoon, because once I was able to convert one spreadsheet. There was simply a for loop around the number of files that were stored in the directory, and the whole thing, as I said, was done within the afternoon. And that's exactly the spirit that you should use when you're writing application software, because it's open source. So you are standing on the shoulder of giants, as in code bases that other people have written for you, that is available on GitLab, on GitHub, and other places where you normally would look out for these. And of course, all of these programming languages, including JavaScript, Golang, Python, Rust, have their own module ecosystem. And for Python, of course, it's the Python package index, also known as PyPy. So my first order of the day, what I normally do, is actually to take pip, which is the front end for PyPy, and search for modules that I'm able to use if I want to write something. Then I download the packages. And then, as I said, simply take a look at the API specification, and simply write the glue code that is missing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, okay. Let me ask you a question on that. Then, I mean, your example is a good example, which I mean, you could do all the same functionality with Linux native tools, right? I think your argument is that it's a lot easier out there to do. You do it with Python, and there are modules available to do that for you.
I've yet to discover a good package manager for Bash or other shells.
yes.
I think there's something out there for PowerShell, but given the fact that I wouldn't call myself a PowerShell expert at all. I know that there's Chocolatey and other package managers for Windows. Mm-hmm. Maybe the same goes for PowerShell's core, which is also available on Linux. But as I said, I haven't done this. But I would use Bash only for kind of small code bases with a limited amount of functionality, because other than that, you're way better off using a real programming language. And before we get hate mail, guys, yes, Bash is a real programming language, as are other shells, don't get me wrong. Mm-hmm. It's just the case that many people just use Bash for simple tasks. That's my take on the situation.
No, that's a fair point. I mean, as you say, for fairly limited small pieces of code which don't require pulling in functionality like reading an Excel specific format, then yes, you wouldn't. You can stick with Bash, right? That's what I do as well. But, okay, good stuff.
So, Martin, if I can ask you a question, given the fact that you've been learning Python for what, the last 6 months, what was your.
I wouldn't say learning.
Okay. I can recall opening up a piece of rotten fruit on a Saturday morning and having some sort of inquiry in my inbox about recommendable Python literature about a year ago, make that 1.5.
Okay.
By a guy called Martin Visser.
Right.
Also known as one of Maybe the co-hosts for something called Linux In-Laws.
revisit this post. Yeah, so I'm still waiting for a proper... note-taking facility for Linux. The ones that you
note-taking facility. There's something called LeafPad.
Yeah, well, one that doesn't require signing up to some centralized service, obviously.
No, LeafPad is essentially just a small text editor that stores files locally on your hard disk.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so does VI, so that's fine. Okay.
If you're looking for a more distributed approach, you want to check out something called Etherpad. If that rings a bell.
I had a quick look last time. Anyway, we digress. But I did look.
But we digress.
the examples you gave me, I haven't been impressed so far. So
okay.
Yeah, sorry, we can cut that out.
Well, Etherpad is written in JavaScript. Yeah, that's right.
Yes. Right then. So, now then, what did strike me about Python was that it has a paradigm for pretty much, well, not I wouldn't say all of them, but many different programming ones, right? So, but how did that come about? Was it just because people said, oh, I like object-oriented, so I'm going to put a bit of that in Python as well? Or was there no...
But it lacks a go-to, right? So imperative only goes so far.
I see.
Okay. I think the idea, and I cannot, of course, speak for Guido, as in Guido von Rossum, the benevolent dictator for life who invented the language almost 30 years
most
ago.
Of his life. Yeah. Could be an M in there, shouldn't it?
yes. But yes. I think the idea was basically to take a look at what's out there and just to provide a better programming environment. So he took imperative paradigms, he took object-oriented paradigms, and yes, to a great deal, and Guido, if you're listening, full marks for this, functional paradigms, Lambdas probably being the prominent example here, and molded a new programming language, interpreter-based, but we get to that in a minute, that addressed the requirements at the time. And the language has evolved an awful lot. For example, there's a Python version 2, and there's a Python and there's a Python version 3. But again, we'll come to that
Python
in a minute.
Is there no Python version 1?
I think Python 1 is obsolete.
Okay. But there was one, okay.
I think so, yes. But I mean, you're talking ancient times here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, yes, and there are differences between Python 2 and Python 3. So Python 3 is not necessarily backwards compatible with Python 2. The other way around, to a certain extent it is, because there's something called a future package that you simply import and that addresses the most prominent difference between 2 and 3. But the idea was to provide a language that is concise, functional, object-oriented, without the deficits of the prevailing programming language at the time, like Perl, I'm almost tempted to say, and other, maybe even scripting languages.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is the philosophy behind Python. You'd see this, especially for concise, probably being the best example. Python is probably the people know who have used Python already, forms blocks by indentation. So the more you indent, the deeper your block level is where you program. So you don't have curly braces, you don't have do, you don't have done statements like you do in other programming languages like C++, C, Rust, Pascal, Modular 2, and so forth. You simply form blocks by indentation, and that's it.
Yeah. Okay, so the argument about that is readability, really, isn't it?
But, exactly. By looking at a code structure, you exactly see where a block starts and where it ends. You don't have to look out for curly braces, for example.
Yes, however, you can do matching, can you? Like you can with curly braces or your do-dones so easily.
This is where a proper IDE comes into place, because an IDE will do that for you.
Yeah, but an IDE is not a language, right?
So what do you mean?
The IDE. But if you... Okay, so if you... I don't know, take a do-done example, right? If you you grep for your do's, you grep for your done's, and you can see if there's one missing, right? You couldn't do that with a piece of Python, because you need to very easily.
Yeah, but I mean, you know exactly where the indentation ends, because you'll see this.
Yes, but you can't grep for it, for example.
Why do you want to grep for it?
Well, if you're debugging or something. No.
Do you know about a module called PDB? I'm just wondering.
PDB. No, I don't.
It comes with any Python installation, and it's a debugger.
Is it something to do with debugging?
Yes. It's a module that is part of the standard library, and you can do debugging on your command line right away.
Cool. Okay.
And that supports packages, modules, functions, line numbers, you name it.
Cool.
And of course, for the hipsters among the listeners, you can use PyCharm. You can use IntelliJ plugins. You can use Eclipse plugins.
VS Code.
VS Code, of course. Even I think the Python mode in Emacs has a debugger interface.
Ooh.
For those of you who are tired of using Vim. I'm just saying.
Okay. That's too much complexity anyway for me.
Vim is, yes. Emacs is straightforward, I know.
Okay. Excellent. So that was really why so many of those different programming paradigms was a good idea at the time by Guido.
But I still think he did a very good job, because only 30 years on, Python is, if Stack Overflow and any other surveys are anything to go by, a very popular language.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Similar to English, Italian, maybe even American or Spanish.
American, is that a language?
I think it is, yes. Maybe I'm wrong.
Okay. Yeah, so that kind of brings me on to the related point, which is, it's popular, but will it remain this way, and is it necessarily a good thing, right? Take Java, right? I mean, Java was very popular, and now it's on the decline, and so on and so on and so on.
I wonder why.
Why don't you tell me?
How much time do we have?
Yeah. Luckily, I avoided all the Java.
I mean, at the end of the day, programming language are like cars, women, and men. You know the one? You know them?
Fruit? No?
Yeah, fruit, maybe. You know one of them, you know them pretty much all, but they do differ. That's the point that I'm making here before we get any hate mail.
Wow, yeah, that's a bad generalization, isn't it?
Yes, indeed, very much so. No, they all serve their purpose, goes without saying.
True.
Yes,
true.
So the likes of Kim Kardashian is not necessarily comparable to the likes of Maggie Thatcher, for want of a better comparison. You get the idea. Anyway, no, jokes aside, Python has a couple of traits that makes it not necessarily unique, but different, okay. Let's put it this way. For example, it's a script-based language, so you don't have a compiler in place per se. There are compiler-based implementations, like PyPy and other stuff that deploy JITs as in just-in-time compilers, but the standard C Python implementation is a scripting engine. So it takes your source code, it parses it, it constructs something called an AST, an abstract syntax tree, which is then translated into an intermediate language, which is then interpreted by something very similar to a JVM, as in a Java virtual machine, only because it's not Java, it's not a virtual machine in terms of it doesn't have the complexity of a JVM, but the interpreter that works on the generated code is in functionality very comparable to the JVM. There have been multiple other approaches to tackling this problem, because doing it that way has a certain performance issue.
Of course.
For example, there's something called Nutka, details in the show notes. There's something called PyPy. There's something called Cython that basically take your Python code and translate this into machine language in one shape or another, using various approaches. There's also, for example, something called Jython, I think it's called, that takes your Python code and transforms it into a format that a JVM can understand. So you are able to execute Python on your in your JVM ecosystem, which comes in handy if you're a Java fanboy, I suppose.
Except that you're not writing in Java.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But rather proper programming language.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, and the things like garbage collection come with that as well, obviously. But yeah, so if we okay, so the scripting, it's what's it good for, right? It's good for past development, prototyping, blah blah blah. If you, however, were to write a, I don't know, say a low-level driver for something, you wouldn't resort to Python,
Not necessarily, no, because that,
right?
for that you would use something much more, much closer to the hardware, like C or maybe even Rust.
Yeah. So if we talk about the advantages of Python, what would you say they are?
Well, the comprehensive ecosystem immediately comes to mind. I mean, there
Yeah.
are significant code bases written in Python, not necessarily open source. Do you know a company called Dropbox? Dropbox, if you take a very close look, both the server side that you don't see, but the client side even, is implemented in Python.
Cool.
So it's cross-platform, it works on your Mac, it works on your Linux system, it works on your Windows system, but
Yeah.
under the hood, it's still Python.
Okay.
Fun fact, Guido, after working for Google, Guido defected to Dropbox, being the benevolent dictator for life. I should probably explain what a BDFL is.
Yeah, what
A
is a
BDFL
BDFL?
is somebody who gives a project direction. So Guido invented the language. Guido still, although he stepped down as the main caretaker of Python, Guido still drives the direction, drives the roadmap for the project. Although, like with any other large project, Python is at the end of the day a community project. So let's take a look at how the language is developed. You have something called PEPs, standing for Python Enhancement Proposals, where simply people describe what they see as the next big step for Python. For example, there's a very famous PEP 404. Martin, does that ring a bell?
I'm afraid that's HTML
Very close, yes.
error,
HTML
isn't
404 means page not found, if I'm not completely mistaken. For Python, it describes the state of development and the timeline for something called Python 2.8.
Okay, cool.
Martin slowly discovers what this is all about. PEP 404 explains that there won't be a Python 2.8, but rather the development will stop at a point in time.
Continuous increase of Python 2.7,
Something along these lines, and
yeah.
then all the code bases should be shifted or to be or should be migrated to use a better expression, to something called Python 3, because Guido and friends clearly saw the benefits of not having to maintain two different versions. I'm exaggerating, but you get the drift, of a language in parallel. And that point in time was actually the 1st of January of this year. Quite a few major distributions, Red Hat probably being the best example, have decided to continue to maintain Python 2, the Python 2 code base for their respective distributions. So, for example, Red Hat still backports security fixes to Python 2.7.
Yeah, when you say maintain, you mean yeah, bug fixes,
The, yeah, there, yeah,
presumably.
bug fixes and security enhancements. No new functionality, of course. That goes without saying. The idea, of course, is that quite a few of, especially their larger customers, have millions, if not billions, of lines of code written in Python 2. So that's a significant investment, and as you can imagine, migrating this to Python 3 is a significant effort. So normally you would do this in a phased approach, but given the fact that PEP 404, I think, dates back to 2008, 2007, if I'm not completely mistaken, PEP 404 to the majority of the people in 2019 was pretty much like Christmas. Nobody told you it's going to be there, but all over a sudden, all overnight, just overnight, it's there without you knowing it, right? Because just because of the fact that 10 years ago somebody told you, sorry, we won't develop this any further, and the 1st of January 2020 is the absolute deadline for this. Hey, you couldn't care less, right?
Sounds a bit like Brexit, yeah. Okay.
Very similar, yes. So the idea is, of course, that that nobody really kind of had a clear migration strategy that they started to plan in 2015, leaving them, say, 5 years' time to meet that deadline, but rather discovered the fact that, oh, yeah, PEP 404 was out in the open for at least 10 years, but we couldn't care less. But now we have this shitload of a code base to maintain, so what should we do? Especially given the fact that it's open source, and if it's not maintained, that leaves a pretty decent attack surface.
Hmm.
Meaning that if you do not backport security fixes, your Python code base written for Python 2 tends to increase in vulnerability all the time. Especially if more and more 0 days, as in security issues where there's no bug fix yet developed before, see the light of day. And that's exactly the issue. So that's the reason why, as I said, why the likes of Red Hat and so forth decided to backport security fixes or other big fixes so that the attack surface still can be maintained on a minimal level. But anybody out there is strongly advised, and I'm almost tempted to name a company very close to our hearts, probably to be the prime example here, to get their shit in order in terms of getting a migration strategy in place, if not already executing on it, to move all their Python 2 legacy code to Python 3 immediately, if they haven't done this yet.
Yeah.
Because going forward, you will just see the security issues increasing out in the wild, especially if you're developing code that is customer-facing, internet-facing. You want to have your house in order. Simple as that.
As in supplying it with a product that you're selling. Yeah. Okay, sorry. Before we continue on the Python 2 and 3 discussion, I want to go back to the BDFL topic. Because essentially, Guido was running the project on his own until he stepped down, and
no, he didn't.
What did he do?
If you take a look at the mailing list, it has been always a community effort. Guido, of course, had the final say in matters.
Well, this is
hence
the D for dictator, right?
But I mean, if you take a look at the PEPs have been written by the community, and the whole approval process was done by the community.
But
Guido still had the final say. And I think that was the cause for, what was it, 571, 572?
Okay.
That caused him actually to step down as a BD.
Now, yes. So, yes. So now there is a committee doing these decisions?
There has always been a committee. It just...
No.
It just Guido had the last say.
Yes. But now the committee has the last say, yes?
I think so, yes.
But that's the whole point of the stepping down activity, sure.
There's something called the PSF, the Python Software Foundation, which is now a formalized body. Not too sure if the committee is now part of the PSF, because I'm not really that involved with the shenanigans going on at the PSF. But the PSF is essentially in charge of maintaining the package index, as in PyPI. Doing events, so like for example the PyCon would be organized by the PSF or its subsidiaries, and of course funding various activities around the language, like maintaining python.org and all the rest of it. So that would be the prime purpose of the prime purpose of the PSF. And of course the PSF is sponsored by the likes of the big the usual suspects, like the likes of Microsoft, the likes of Red Hat, and so forth. It's a community body essentially, tasked with promoting the language, standardizing the language, and keeping the shit together.
Okay, excellent. I'm still confused about that.
Dear listeners, Martin is easily confused, but that's okay.
Well, either someone, Guido makes the decisions, or someone else does now. What was the point of stepping down otherwise?
As I said, the community I think they had a committee before, but Guido being part of the committee had the final say. Now it's a much, I wouldn't say much more democratic effort, but it's more a group effort, let's put it this way, of deciding. because the BDFL is essentially gone. He still works. In the background, you'll see this with, what is the PEP for this PEG parser? Sorry, people, Python 3.9 will have a PEG parser in contrast to, what is it, the existing LL1 parser. And this is, I think, outlined in PEP, let me look it up. 596 talks about the 3.9 release schedule, and the PEP for the parser is, yes, 617. So 617 is the improvement of for CPython as part of the Python release 3.9, where actually Guido says, let's replace the LL1 parser with a PEG parser. And this PEP is written by Guido von Rossum himself. So never mind the fact that he stepped down, he's still involved in the development of the language.
Indeed, indeed.
Because that PEP, actually, I'm just looking at the PEP page, was created no less on the 24th of March this year. Excellent. So more than a year after he stepped down, if I'm not completely mistaken.
Okay, good stuff. Yeah, so I mean, I'm not disputing the fact that he's not no longer involved, that he is not still involved, but more the final approval of PEPs, right? That is now a different process.
Yes. Yes? It's much more community oriented. That's correct. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. All right. So going back, where were we? Yeah. So Python 2.3, we touched on reasonably. So I believe there's also a utility out there. Have you had any experience with that?
Yes, 2.3 it's called. Essentially, it's a pluggable framework of helping you, or for helping you with migrating your 2.3 code base on a more or less automated fashion. It takes care of the most prominent suspects for you automatically. For example, the main difference between Python 2 and Python 3 is, depending on your level of knowledge and your background, of course, print is a statement in Python 2 and it's a function in Python 3. So in Python 3, you have to decorate this with braces because it's not a statement anymore. Otherwise, Python will bark at you. This is the level of automation that Python can take care of. As with any other automation tool, it has to be taken with a grain of salt. Yes, it will take care of the most prominent differences for you automatically, but you're strongly advised to do a proper code base review afterwards, making sure that not only the syntax, but also the semantics are changed. Another big thing is, of course, for example, between Python 2 and Python 3 is string handling. Python 2 treats strings as a sequence of characters, pretty much like C. Whereas in Python 3, strings are UTF-8 collection of characters. Because sequences of single 8-bit characters would be represented by bytes, like a byte array or byte sequence. So it's that level of detail that you have to watch out for. And of course, as usual, the devil lies in the details. So 2.3, yes, can help you an awful lot, especially given the fact that you just give it a directory and it simply takes a look at the Python files in the directory and then converts them one by one. But it won't help you with doing a full system integration test, never mind user acceptance, before you deploy this in production. Tools only go so far, people. As usual, human intelligence has to be applied afterwards.
Good stuff. Yeah, no, that's very sensible. I mean, as you say, it's the same with any automation tool, right? And it kind of comes down to how have you built your whole pipeline of development.
Absolutely,
and QA,
yes.
And how you've automated that. Okay, so do we think that 2 will ever die as such?
Yep, it's penciled in for the 24th of March 2024, and I think that's a Sunday, if I'm not completely mistaken. I might be wrong on the particular weekday, but that's the point in time when Python 2 definitely will die It's part of CPython as in the standard implementation. The reference implementation will cease to function on that date, if I'm not completely mistaken.
Right.
And of course, okay, that's my attempt at humor. For those people who missed it. No, it basically boils down to the fact that how many companies are willing to maintain a dying code base in terms of the Python 2, CPython reference implementation? Because CPython, and that comes with any operating system that Python supports, is your standard implementation. You find this on Windows, you find this on OS X, you find this actually on Linux and other Unix derivatives. This is your reference implementation that will work on any platform. And it's just a matter of how willing are people to put effort into this code base for Python 2, because it's dying. There won't be any functional improvements, only security fixes and bug fixes will enter the code base based on your distribution vendor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So we're saying, well, I mean, let me say, CPython being the reference implementation.
CPython.
Are there any others out there?
Oh, yeah. I think I touched upon them already. You have something called Cython. You have the just-in-time compilers. And then you have other language ecosystems aimed at different execution environments, like, for example, Jython. There's also something called IronPython, using a similar approach. I mean, they all have their advantages and disadvantages. For example, there's something out there called, what's it called, Martin?
I don't know. What are we talking about?
You mentioned this, right? You mentioned something called Stack.
Stackless.
Stackless. Yes. Sorry. Yes.
Yes.
Stackless. Stackless. Martin discovered the fact that Stackless is just another Python implementation, but in contrast to CPython and similar to other Python implementations, it only maintains a certain version of Python. So the trouble, of course, with the other language ecosystems is that, in contrast to CPython, they may only support Python 3.1.2.3.4.5, but only CPython, because its reference implementation has the newest language standard implemented. So while we're on the subject of Stack Exchange, Martin, why is that important for you?
Stackless.
Stackless, sorry, yes, not Stack Exchange.
Stack Exchange,
yes.
Is a,
it's something different.
Something. Why is it important to me? Okay, so yeah, three ways of doing parallel processing, multi processing, whatever you want to call it, making use of CPU cores in Python, right? Threading, multi processing, and well, potentially async IO. Async IO doesn't really help you with parallelizing jobs so much, but
does it not? Okay. Are you on mute?
Well, I was asking the question. So,
yeah. Hang on! That doesn't necessarily mean that I can't ask back, right?
Yeah, lost my train of thought.
Okay. Okay. Why doesn't async IO help you with parallelism?
Why doesn't async IO? What, sorry?
Why doesn't async IO help you with parallelizing your application?
Well, okay, we are. Okay, well, in my view, it's purely about whether you wait for the a response or not, right? So, how is this actually parallelizing something on multiple cores?
This is a very important differentiation, people. Okay, mm-hmm. let's take a quick step back and let's take a look at the difference between processes, threads, user-level threads, and something called coroutines.
Okay.
You want to give it a shot, Martin, or should I take it from here?
You're the expert.
I'm the expert. Okay. Now,
I will comment.
Yes, exactly. Please do correct my biggest mistakes in the following explanations, by all means, Mr. Wister, by all means. Okay. You have something, the term operating system rings a bell? You've probably heard about this before. And operating system
next,
has...
Next step is one.
Yes, very much so, like Linux and other operating systems, exactly. Yeah. And operating systems tend to have something called a kernel.
Uh-huh.
The kernel is in charge of driving the lower level, driving the lower levels of the system, like talking to the hardware, and also very important, allocating CPU slices to something called the user land. The user land, of course, is where applications live, like the shells, like the IDEs of the world, like your Python code that is executed by CPython.
Okay, hang on.
Yes.
Right. I mean, these are just processes.
Very important, yes.
Okay.
Martin, what is a process? Going back to your uni days, a process consists of what?
Well, it depends. Yeah.
No, it doesn't depend.
No. It does depend. A process is an abstract construct.
Let me rephrase the question.
Not necessary. It's a Linux process.
Let me rephrase the question. What does in Linux a process entail?
Well, it's basically an executable that runs on a. That's part of the CPU allocation for running, right?
Almost correct.
Piece of code.
In Linux, like other operating systems, especially the ones that are able to deal with virtualized memory, consists of something called an address space, a set of registers, especially an instruction pointer, a stack. And what did I miss? Yeah, we forget about the likes of file descriptors.
Yeah, okay. You're talking about the internals of a process.
Yes, and now the important bit: one or more so-called threads.
Okay.
And this is the important bit, people. This is all you need, because a process in Linux and other operating systems is an execution context.
Mm-hmm.
So typically in the olden days, before the invention of threads, you had in a typical Unix process, you had a virtualized address space, you had a set of memory pages, and the rest was essentially residing on disk in something called a swap space, and you had a program counter and a set of registers. This process could be interrupted at any time by the kernel. Going back to my earlier description about slices, that's exactly how you implement a multi-user multitasking operating system. And then OS2 and other hipster operating systems came along and invented something or brought something with them called threads. Now you did have more than one execution context per process. And Windows NT being the copycat.
Yep.
Essentially took this from OS2 and implemented this in Windows. But then POSIX came along and implemented this for other for other operating systems as well. So any other before they hate us some email, POSIX of course being a standard, people wrote the standard so the OS implementers could implement POSIX compliant interfaces for this functionality, just to be correct here. So essentially the way it works is basically a process, and that goes for Linux, that goes for OS X, that goes for Windows, and any other new or modern operating systems, a process has still a virtualized, or an address space in general, has still a set of registers, but now has at least one thread. You can have more than one thread, meaning that you have to synchronize them accordingly, because they all run in the same address space. And if they want to do concurrent accessing of one particular address, that access has to be synchronized, because otherwise you will have race conditions and other fun stuff. For those of you who have ever used threads, you know what I'm talking about. So that introduces the whole notion of concurrent programming, including locks, semaphore, signals, you name it. They're all present in Linux, and they're all present in Windows, they're all present in OS X. But the important thing is that a thread, at the end of the day, is still a kernel entity. The kernel knows how to create them. The kernel knows how to schedule threads, even running in the same address space. And the kernel knows also how to end threads if the application doesn't do it. Similar to the way a kernel knows how to create processes. This is the important distinction. So if you want to, for example, if you have a blocking thread, just imagine the situation where a user land thread blocks on a system call in your application. The kernel takes away the processing time while this thread is blocking and allocates the CPU slice to a different thread, maybe even in a different application. And now the main distinction between something called tasklets, green threads, or even coroutines is that these entities are purely driven by the user land. The kernel doesn't know about them. This is the main difference, people.
Moving it up a level. Yeah.
And the main benefit of the latter approach is, of course, you do not have the expensive context switch. Because if you want to reschedule a threat, the CPU has to enter the kernel context. The kernel has to make an important decision of whether to suspend the current thread and resume a different one, and then to resume execution of that thread or a different one. That means always you basically enter the kernel address space. That always means a context switch, and from a CPU scheduling perspective, that's a very expensive operation in terms of microseconds that you're spending with it on this. In contrast to this, user level entities like green threads, like coroutines, like tasklets, you name them, or what's the abstraction in Golang? I can't even remember. It's not channels, but something similar. These are purely userland entities. The kernel doesn't get involved. The language environment, as in CPython, in the Python case, takes a decision of how to schedule them. That makes these entities, in comparison to operating system threads, pretty damn fast, because you don't have to enter the kernel. You don't have to do that context switch into the kernel address space. This is the main benefit. And coroutines in the shape of async.io, in the shape of tasklets, as introduced by Stacklist and all the rest of them, are just examples for this. So if you do an await in Python, if you're prone to async.io programming, this await is actually handled by CPython itself. The kernel doesn't see it. This is the important bit.
That's very well explained.
Excellent. Okay, now it's time, I think, for the feedback.
Okay. Do we have feedback?
I think we do, yeah. Marketing got in touch. And essentially, the listener survey is back. Sales wasn't too impressed with the whole New York debacle. I'm sure you heard about this.
Do tell.
Yes, somebody from, you see, this is the problem, Martin, right? If you set up shop north of Central Park, as in Harlem, the Bronx isn't too far away. Okay, there's a bigger picture involved, people here. About a year ago, Martin had this grand idea of, we need an outlet in New York City. So we got the board involved, we ran the numbers, checks out, we go there. Martin is under the impression we need some sort of outfit in Williamsburg, as in Brooklyn, because this is where the hipsters are, fair enough, or even lower Manhattan. And I says, no, Martin, this is going to be pretty expensive. We need a mortgage and we need a credit line for this. This is the important bit, right? So we visit a couple of banks, and this is basically where the real shit starts. We are facing this lady about late 30s, maybe early 40s, about 200 pound, but all in the right places. I get her down to about 9% annual. And right from the point when we walk into the room, she gives Martin the look. She eyes up Martin big. I mean, I wasn't even in the picture. So we sat down, and constantly she's trying to connect with my beloved co-host, only to hear and listen to this, people. This is great. Only to hear these famous words: "I do not do overweight middle-aged women." Let this sink in. Martin at the meeting utters these famous words: you're not my type." Rather than saying, "I'm happily married," or "the wife wouldn't approve," but in brackets, "I would." But that's beside the point. So, Martin, this is what is known as taking one for the team, right? Which you didn't do.
Isn't that your own?
No, Martin, I had to do this. As a matter of fact, I had to take three for the team, only to get a decent mortgage out of her.
Good job, that man. Yeah.
Okay,
because
because of this mishap, for want of a better expression,
I thought it was quite a success person.
We ended up with an outfit in upper Harlem, and of course the Bronx isn't too far away, so you get all these blown-ins and they wreck your outfit. So sales wasn't impressed. But how did I end up here? Listener survey, exactly. Saints complained about it, but according to the marketing department, we have about 6.5 listeners these days. And Claudio being one of them, I think.
Well, he was until last episode.
He sent a mail saying, "Good job. I really like the review of the review. Let me get back to you." I don't know whether that's a threat or a promise.
Oh, it could be sarcasm.
I see. Okay.
Or are we expecting the review of the review of the review?
Also, the focus groups apparently are doing a pretty good job. They came up with Haskell as the next language to review other than Python. How good are your Haskell skills, Martin?
I heard it mentioned the other day.
Okay. In that case, let's take turns. So I'm going to ask you about Haskell next time around.
That's only fair, right?
You never know what these focus groups are good for, right? Okay.
Joking aside.
No, seriously. I mean.
I did come across someone who mentioned Haskell about something.
Seriously. I mean, marketing came up with these grand proposal of focus groups, and I think they worked out quite well so far. Sales may have a different opinion on this, but sales also is on the opinion we could make lots of money in places like New York, which, if you take a look at the numbers, are not that great at the moment.
No.
Of course, if you had taken at least one for the team, we could have set up shop in Williamsburg because we would have been able to afford that mortgage. But then you had to utter these famous words: "I don't do overweight middle-aged women." Nice.
You're welcome.
I think the next time I will do this by myself. Anyway. Fancies or not. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Okay.
Feedback,
yes.
No? Yes. Feedback.
Frank, Frank wrote.
Frank. So who's Frank?
Frank is somebody who wrote a comment on...
Is he the New York connection?
No, he's not.
Okay.
No, Frank wrote on Hacker Public Radio the following words: "The sketch, sorry to say, I found the sketch rollback cut." He posted on the 15th of June, "The sketch, sorry to say, but I found the sketch not to be funny at all." No, sorry. "The sketch, sorry to say, I found the sketch not funny at all. Not because I'm a Trump supporter, far from it, but it was just not funny in a comical sense. It gave me a sense of Fremdschämen, which is a peculiar German word, my interpretation, and I had to skip over it after listening to the first minute or so. Please also work on your audio balancing. Yes, Frank, that is appreciated, because we are still trying to get things right. I think we have to talk to the post-production people, Martin.
Yes, I think we do.
The
yes,
Polish gang that
I think
that,
they are
that
perhaps
yeah
too,
no
too much on the beer.
The Polish gang.
Beer allowance retracted. Yeah.
The Polish gang that Mark uh-huh. that sales was so fond of doesn't cut the cheese. No, the audio quality. I think I have to go back to do it myself again. I don't know, but let me have a word with post productions or with the general operational department. To my I might add,
yes,
because operations. Haven't been
yeah there was another
great.
Operation issue wasn't there yeah, yeah
recently let's put it this way so
yeah,
I think a serious
some automation problem
yeah mm. I think a serious reorg is actually
heads will roll yes, indeed. Yeah that's catch right and it's to be fired as well
yes so marketing sales operations come to mind let's see what we can what else we can do
yeah.
Okay. Yes, and Frank continues to write. First, there was
the
a
presenters.
Yes, present. No. The presenters would stay there because they make the numbers, right? So you can't fire them. That's for sure. Okay. Frank continues to write. First, there was a low volume talk. Then suddenly, a much louder techno jingle, right before the sketch. Yes, you're right. As I said, let us have a word with the Polish crowd. So that we can make some improvements in this area. Okay. We have to do a POX. Oh, yeah, actually, there is another bit of news that I almost forgot to mention. It's not exactly open source, but I'm not too sure. Yeah. Brad Pitt rings a bell?
It's definitely not open source.
Correct. But Brad Pitt recently moved in with somebody called Alia Shawkat.
Oh, not with your favorite actress, whatever her name is.
Pamela Adlon, no.
I thought we were going to Pamela Adlon episode again.
Are you implying you do not know Alia Shawkat?
Shortcut.
Shawkat. Shawkat.
This is someone's name, you are joking.
No, I'm serious. You don't read...
Someone made this up.
No, you don't read tabloids?
Real name. No. Sure.
Shawkat, yes.
Not. Well, are we talking about S-H-A-W or S-H-O-R-E?
S-H-A-W.
Right. Okay.
No, her name is Alia Shawkat.
Right.
Okay.
Never heard of her. Fine.
The TV sitcom Arrested Development doesn't ring a bell.
No.
And I thought Martin was contemporary. How wrong I was. dear listeners, it might not be a
what
pox.
What's the relevance of this news, actually?
No, they just moved in, and that's shocking.
Yeah, well, people move in all the time.
Yeah,
right? Oh,
it's
news.
Brad Pitt, for God's
news,
sake!
No news. Well, so.
I mean,
my neighbors moved in as well. It's not news.
I mean, that means that Brad Pitt is off the grid, Martin.
Grid? What grid? What's he doing on the grid?
Oh, Jesus. your wife got in touch. I'm just looking at an email of her, and she says that actually you have cancelled your Hello subscription. Yes, it does show.
Okay, good.
No, not good. Because otherwise you would be able to encompass the gravity of the situation, which apparently clearly
I
you
see.
Are not.
Okay, why don't you tell me what the gravity is? I'm curious.
I already mentioned
sort of,
that Brad.
Maybe vaguely.
That
no,
Brad.
No, maybe I'm not, because I don't read well.
I already mentioned the fact that this moving in implies, whatever uh-huh. whatever you're
what,
looking
what,
for.
What?
Implies that Brad Pitt is off the grid.
Yeah.
Meaning, okay, sorry for the more simple-minded among us.
Uh-huh.
What's the one I'm looking for? Martin, help me out
what
here.
About the Brad Pitt support?
No, that means
fans.
That he's not available
anymore. Brad Pitt fanboys.
Essentially, that means that he's not available anymore.
And your point is?
For romantic encounters with a female variety. Although apparently Alia Shawkat is bisexual.
How is this news?
It happened.
What are we talking
it
about
happened
here?
Recently. Hence the name news.
I'm very confused here.
Martin is easily confused because otherwise we would have got that really superb Williamsburg outfit and a lower mortgage rate.
Is this podcast number two, Hello Magazine, the sequel or something?
No, it's still Luke's in-laws. I'm just mentioning the fact that they have moved in together, and now that entails that Brad Pitt is off the grid. Apart from the fact that you can read that that news website also on your Android phone, which of course runs at the end, at the very end of the day, an open source platform. No? Goes without saying.
Okay.
So is the and you find actually the link in the show notes. And unfortunately, it's in German, so let me translate this. Essentially,
The Germans are the sad fans of Brad Pitt. Right.
Yeah, the sad news that it's official. One of the most wanted singles of Hollywood is in a relationship again. Aya Shawkat, age 31, is apparently the lucky one. Yes, at Brad Pitt's side. Is that the way to correct it? There was a long speculation about an affair between the two of them, and the reason for this that they have been sat in public recently, especially at a concert of the soul musician called Thundercat at the beginning of March. Of course, that also leaves, what's her name again, Jennifer Aniston, in somewhat of a tatter, because there was some news during February and March time for the people who follow that sort of thing, as in who have not cancelled their Hello subscription, that apparently Jennifer and Brad were getting together again after Brad publicly split from Angelina Jolie last year, I think it was, or something.
Right.
Now Martin is really confused what the hell this has to do with open source. And of course, the long and short of it, Martin, nothing.
Okay, that's fine. That's fine. Right. I'm sure it will be very much appreciated by our listeners, this news fact.
And that ends episode 10 of something called the Yellow Press Tabloid Podcast. Happy to have you as our solid listener base. Do come back for more information on Brad Pitt, Martin Visser, Aya Shawkat, and of course Jennifer Aniston.
Don't forget Pamela Adlon. Yeah.
Oh, of course Pamela Adlon, and of course what's the other one's name? Pamela of California 19025 fame.
Anderson?
Yes, Pamela Anderson. That's it. The one with the big
nose.
Exactly. Yes, Pamela Anderson. That's the one. Yes. So, guys and gals, you heard it here first.
Well, let's read Hello Magazine.
And yes, dear listeners, do not forget, unlike Martin, to renew your Hello subscription if you are looking for that sort of information. Or, of course, you simply subscribe to the RSS feed on Hacker Public Radio. Yes, we have one by ourselves these days, because we are now looking at the 10th episode. Hacker Public Radio is the place to be for catching up on new episodes of linuxinlaws.eu, which is, of course, our website. Feedback, as usual, is appreciated at feedback@linuxinlaws.eu.
Yes, and more feedback, please, people.
And as I said before, as we said before, anything goes. So if you have any suggestions, like Frank did, and your feedback, of course, is appreciated, never mind how much fun we make at it, send us an email to feedback@linuxindoors.eu, or simply leave a comment on the Hacker Public Radio website.
This podcast is licensed under the latest version of the Creative Commons license, type attribution share alike. Credits for the intro music go to Blue Sea Roosters for the song Solid Market, to Twin Flames for their piece called The Flow, used for the segment intros, and finally to Celestial Ground for their song Sweet Justice, used by the Dark Side. You find these and other ditties licensed under CC at Jamendo, a website dedicated to liberate the music industry from choking copyright legislation and other crap concepts.
Right, you're so as a child, did you have many toys?
Oh, very much so. Yes.
Okay.
You didn't?
Did they involve much taking apart?
More often than not, they did. Yes.
Okay, well, just checking.
Cut! And there's the phone. Here. Yes.
Answer phone.
Yes.
Got it.
Let me turn this off.
Wow, you still have this?
Yes, I do.
Why?
It goes hand in hand with the disposable phones used for drug selling. Yes.
It's one of the many phone lines, isn't it?
Unfortunately, I cannot go into the details right now. Okay. Yeah. Rolling again.
Cut rolling. Yes.
You were talking about the. You asked me if I had toys as a child.
Yes. Yes. Sorry. Okay. Right. Yes. So toys as a child, taking things apart, great stuff. Finding out how things work. And then for a lot of people, kind of life takes over at a certain point.
What's life? I heard about the concept, but
well, at some point it will stop. I guess you haven't caught on. To the point.
I see.
It starts and then it got a bit in the middle. Anyway.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.